From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. Thanks for joining us. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. We'll begin this week's episode with a conversation about the morality of wealth. In other words, is it morally wrong, for example, to own a $250 million apartment in New York City when there are thousands of people who are homeless in the city? Our guest offered perspective on different sides of that issue.
In this clip, you'll hear John Kalia, an executive coach and author of The Reluctant CEO, Succeeding Without Losing Your Soul. But first, here's Michael Kink, executive director of the Strong Economy for All Coalition.
I do think it's obscene when a hedge fund manager in Chicago buys a $238 million apartment just for himself, and we have 89,000 homeless people in New York, right? I've worked on anti-poverty and anti-homeless efforts my entire public career, and I just think that that's wrong. The academic studies demonstrate that super wealthy people don't migrate from state to state based on adjustments in marginal income taxes. Cristobal Young is a professor now at Cornell. He used to be at Stanford. Good job, Cornell, on getting him. He is the primary academic. If you go to his website, cristobalyoung.org or .com, I'm not quite sure. I'll pull it up for you. You can show the studies that you can see the studies that demonstrate that people do not flee based on modest adjustments in state tax rates. They build their companies and their businesses where they're successful, or they inherit their wealth, right? There's a lot of people in New York that are rich because their parents were rich and their grandparents were rich. Generational wealth is getting bigger and bigger as a portion of folks' income. So if we did the ultra-millionaires tax, if we did this pied-à-terre tax on the second and third and fourth and fifth homes of the global ultra-rich, we'd have enough money to put about $1.5 billion into our public school systems everywhere in the state, and about $1.5 billion into property tax rebates that could actually reduce people's property taxes. So I think tax fairness is important in public policy, part of what government is responsible to doing, So a lot of the fights we have around the Capitol in Albany boil down to some level of morality and ethics. What's the right thing to do? What's fair? And at this point, so much of public policy at the state level benefits a tiny, tiny few, and it doesn't benefit the vast majority of people. That's what we're talking about. It's small-d democracy.
Okay, John Kalia, do you think there is anything immoral about having a $50 million apartment in New York City?
No, I don't think it's immoral. It's not immoral to have money. It's not immoral to make money. It's not immoral to have thousands of times more money than anyone else. That in and of itself does not make one immoral. We certainly have seen episodes, if you will, or examples of people who have a lot of money doing egregious things, but it's not money that corrupts people, it's power. And it doesn't matter whether it's corporate power or government power. And in this state, we have a government that aggregates power, a governor in particular who aggregates power by taxing at extreme levels, and then deciding how to distribute that money. And you could call that a moral argument or an expression of people's values, but from my perspective, the way in which we contribute to the economy should be a reflection of our values rather than the way in which the state taxes us and redistributes our income. So when I hear words like obscene and immoral in the context of fairness, what I think we're doing is characterizing the engine of our prosperity as something that's evil, and I really object to that characterization.
Next, the Rochester Association of Black Journalists celebrates 15 years as an organization this month. We invited several RABJ members on the program to discuss the group's work diversifying newsrooms and ensuring balanced coverage of communities of color.
In this clip, our guests discuss how people of color are often portrayed in the media. Stories about crime and violence in the city of Rochester are frequently placed at the top of newscasts, leading some viewers to characterize parts of the city as dangerous places to be avoided. You'll hear Richard McCullough, chief meteorologist at WDKX, and journalist Kevin Hicks comment on that issue. But first, here's Erica Bryant, columnist and reporter at the Democrat and Chronicle.
Fear sells. I mean, the way to get people to watch something is to make them frightened or to activate that center of the brain where fear lives. I mean, that's just, if you're trying to make money, that's what you do.
And it is hard news. I mean, that's called hard news, as you well know. You know, I'll tell you something that to that point. A few years ago, I participated in a program that the mayor had, Mayor Johnson had, where he paired professionals. And I was paired with a Greece policeman. And so I had a chance to ride with him in Greece. And he was telling me about a lot of things that happened in the suburbs that you'll never hear about on the news. They'll never report murders or, you know, suicides and all kinds of weird things go on in the suburbs that don't get to the newsrooms, which was kind of interesting. He came to my job at Channel 13 and saw what I did as a meteorologist. But that's one example there. A lot of things that happened in the outlying areas you may not hear about on the news. But you certainly hear about everything in the city.
Or something that gets covered from, you know, a suburban, attractive white teenager goes missing. That is a story that's wall-to-wall.
Well, to your point, when we were talking about diversifying the newsrooms, I think we also have to look toward the suburban papers. When I look on the website, I could be wrong, but I don't see journalists of color in the suburban papers, in our business papers. I think that may be at the same time that we are trying to get more journalists of color in the newsrooms of the mainstream papers. That may be also why you see entrepreneurship happening. Juanita Washington with her Breakthrough magazine. You've got Rodney Brown with the Southwest Tribune. You've got Upstate Gospel New York. Manuel Floyd, I think I may have his last name incorrect, but there are a number that have started up, and I'm sure that Jim and Carolyn Blunt, who started About Time magazine years ago, are overjoyed by this entrepreneurship.
Yeah, Minority Reporter, The Challenger, which has been around since the 60s. Yeah, there are a lot of other publications that do get out there and report what's happening.
Erica, how do you see the stories that we choose to cover and not cover? Because we've got a limited amount of time on the radio. You've got limited number of inches in space and getting less, unfortunately, over the years. The stories we choose to cover and not cover, I think, probably are a little bit reflective of our own identities. Again, conscious or not, are there certain things that you think are not covered either well or enough, or covered too much, or covered, you know, ought to be approached differently?
I think that, and this also is a resource issue. So I think that, for example, there was just wall-to-wall tons of coverage of the meteorologist slur. And in part, you know, it's because people were talking about it on social media and it was, you know, scandal, et cetera, et cetera. But also because it's kind of easy to cover. It doesn't really take a whole lot of resources. But the kinds of stories that I think are extremely important that sort of take a lot of time and a lot of effort, a lot of going through, for example, court reports. I'll give you an example of a story that I would love to do myself personally. So this is something that, you know, I haven't gotten to because I haven't had time. But just to look at the kinds of institutional, structural things that are really just crushing African Americans. For the problem of pretrial incarceration, I mean, the numbers of people who are being held and have been convicted of no crime simply because they cannot or their families cannot come up with $500, $1,000 for bail. I mean, there are just thousands and thousands of people who are losing, you know, years of their lives. And it is a large percentage of those people, or a disproportionate number of those people, are African-American because we're disproportionately poor. And I think those kinds of stories don't get as much coverage as they should because it just takes a lot of time. Like, you have to go through court records. You have to sit in court hearings. You have to get people who are willing to tell their story. You have to do it's a lot of work. It's a lot of time. It's a lot of somebody you have to be paying, you know, by the hour to do all these stories. So I think that stories that require investigation, like sort of that old school investigative reporting where you uncover something that otherwise wouldn't be known, those stories are what we need to have more of. And without the resources issue, it's just, it's hard to, you do the best you can. And I'm sure that all the working journalists in Rochester are doing the best they can with the limited resources that they have. But there's so much under the surface and so much under the rug and so many just really awful things going on that needs some sunlight.
We'll end the week with a conversation about parenting and climate change, Author and climate activist Mary DeMocker grew up in Webster. She now lives in Oregon and has written a book called The Parent's Guide to Climate Revolution. It's a series of tips and guidelines for how to raise kids that love and appreciate nature and are conscious about how to build a sustainable future.
In this clip, DeMocker shares what she did with her children when they were young to try to limit screen time and maximize their time outdoors.
They're 23 and 19 now. We're pretty hardcore. I just want to put that out there right now that I can say that I've lived through this and I can tell you what I've done. I do believe that it's harder to do what I've done than it was when I started 23 years ago. So I really want to acknowledge that up front, that some of the things I did are harder because there weren't cell phones when I started parenting my now 23-year-old. But I do have a 19-year-old son who I've been working with for several years on all the issues that a lot of parents are facing today. So one of the things that we did, which is pretty hardcore, but we did it, was we didn't take them to the movie theater until they were 9. They didn't watch videos until they were at least 7. And what we did instead was we surrounded ourselves with other people who were also doing the same thing. We were consciously keeping our kids off of movies and TV, and we were keeping them outdoors. We did a lot of camping, a lot of sports in our backyard. So we had a climbing wall that our neighbor was getting rid of, and we put that up when the kids were little. We had swing sets. We bought a trampoline when our daughter was 3, and we felt she was spending too much time indoors. And we live in a rainy area, but it's out in Oregon. But it's warm enough, you know, if you bundle up or put on rain gear, to be outside. And she was outside every day after school from then on. It was the best investment that we made. So I think it's important not to just tell kids, hey, don't be on screens. It's important to model being off screens and to create a family life that's centered on nature immersion and family connection and community connection.
And for the parents who think, well, if I did that, if I waited to introduce them to screens until they were 7 or 8 or 9, would it then hit them like a drug? Like, whoa, right. Where has this been?
Right.
How did it happen for your kids?
It didn't hit them like a drug because we kept the same program going. We just changed what the things were in the backyard. And we made sure that there were gyroscopes and things to fiddle with and ukuleles and puzzles in the living room. So I think there's a lot in my book about things you can do to build an alternative, you know, keep them in the real world. But I do want to say that my kids, we kept them off of gaming. They had 20 minutes starting in fourth grade, and they weren't allowed anything that involved killing or even for the first couple of years, anything involving violence in any way. So it was little pigs, you know, building up blocks and things and racing pieces of fruit. And that happened until 16 for my son. Maybe 15, he started having punching things, but 20 minutes a day until he was 16. And at that point, would I say that he was culturally competent? Yeah, because he was going to his friends' houses and he would see what they were doing and he would sometimes do them. But honestly, he wasn't that interested because what he was seeing was that his friends were staying up half the night. They weren't necessarily doing the sports that he was doing. They weren't playing guitar that he was doing. They weren't doing a lot of they're wonderful kids. So I'm not saying that they weren't doing anything. I'm saying that the bulk of their free time, what he was seeing with some of his friends, was spent doing passive consumer entertainment. And he didn't feel that that was something he wanted to be around. He wanted to be creating things, building things out in the woods. But yes, is there an allure? Sure. Does he watch more than he would like at 19? Yes, he says that he now is on more than he would like, and he's working on that. He's reflecting.
I think a lot of us are.
A lot of us are. I am.
I am.
Yeah, Facebook and YouTube is so alluring. Movies. I mean, who doesn't want to just at the end of the day, I don't want to have to think anymore. Give me whatever. I actually don't have Netflix anymore, so I don't even know what's on now. Things about the White House.
And, yeah.
It's important for me to model also for them that I'm not addicted to TV shows. I'm not even that drawn to them because I wouldn't be doing the work that I'm doing. I can hardly keep up as it is without also spending 2, 3, 4 hours a day on screens, watching YouTube, and watching TV.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS, Finger Lakes Public Radio. That's 89.5 FM.
We are also on the WXXI mobile app. He's Evan. I'm Megan. Have a great weekend, everyone. We'll talk to you Monday.